stood, tossing coins to the table, and turned to go, Kamen right behind him. Then he paused and turned back to the table of seven men.
"So, if I'm going to stay a few days," he said with studied disinterest, pretending he didn't care, "where would be a good place to put up? Honest place, not too expensive, but clean?"
"Harry's got rooms by the week at his place," said one of the men at the table,
and his companions all murmured agreement.
"Left as you walk out the door, then not but a quarter mile from here," someone else directed. 2.5 stories, easy to find."
"Appreciate it," Justin said, nodding again, and walked out the door. They found Harry's with no trouble, and Justin haggled just loud enough and long enough to convince anyone who might be listening that he didn't have much money but did intend to stay a while. Eventually, they agreed on the attic bedroom, Justin to take care of all his own needs, and a weekly bath thrown in. When they climbed to the third floor, they found two narrow, lumpy beds, a window that wouldn't open, and severely slanted roof lines that allowed Justin to stand only in the very center of the room.
"Well, you definitely don't want to be courting a woman if this is the place you'd be bringing her back to," Kamen said.
"Slept in worse," Justin said, slinging his travel pack onto one of the beds.
He'd left the bulk of his possessions with his horse at Delz's stables.
"So have you."
"And will again,"
Kamen agreed, stretching out on the other bed.
"So, what will you do tomorrow?"
"Go back to Delz, take his job, spend a couple of days in the city looking around, trying to see if there's any activity. I want to be in place a few days before I go off roving toward the convent. I don't want to make people suspicious."
"How long are you going to be here?"
Justin shrugged, irritable again.
"Senef thinks a couple of months. I don't know. I suppose till they call me home."
"Maybe I can come back and visit in a few weeks."
"That'd be good. Taze said he'd send messengers now and then so I can give him news. Maybe he meant he'd send you."
Kamen sat up, swinging his legs over the side of the bed. His odd eyes were alight with excitement.
"I know. You can try to send me information. See if I can pick up on it all the way in Gosenhall."
Justin laughed in disbelief.
"And do you think you can?"
"I don't know. Maybe. I knew something was wrong with Seneth the other day, and I was worried, but she'd only turned her ankle."
"And you were both in Gosenhall," Justin reminded him. "Not hundreds of miles apart. Besides, what kind of information do you think I could send you? Details about troop movements? Names of nobles who have come to visit Coralinda Gieseltess? You can't pick up on anything so specific, can you?"
"I don't think so," Kamen said regretfully. "But you could try."
Justin rolled his eyes.
"All right, I'll try, if I remember. We'll see how good you really are."
They talked a while longer, but they were both tired, and these were the first real beds, however uncomfortable, that they'd had for more than a week. So it wasn't long before they both started yawning, then dropped off to sleep. In the morning, they shared a quick breakfast and headed to the stables. Kamen was gone with a cheerful wave, and Justin was left moody and alone. Well, alone except for Dell's.
"So, did you give any thought to taking a job here?" the stableman asked.
Justin nodded and said, "Sign me up." He was here, and he would do his best, because that was what Taze expected of him. But he couldn't bring himself to be happy about his circumstances. What was a rider without riders at his back? There was nothing for him in Neft. He would endure his sentence of separation, but he would find it an entirely joyless time.
Chapter 3 Eleanor stood in the courtyard with all the other girls and turned her face up toward the quarter moon. Cool, finally, now that the sun was down, now that a breeze had bothered to meander in from the west. The stone walls of the convent, white to reflect the light, still managed to hold enough of the summer's heat to make some of the smaller rooms unbearable, but it was almost autumn now. Soon, thank the mother, to be winter again, cold, still, crystalline. Chevelle led the prayers tonight, facing the rest of them, her eyes closed, and her thin hands moving with bird-like motions through the phases. In the darkness, Chevelle's violet robes looked almost as black as the Lestra's, though you would never mistake one woman for the other. The Lestra was shorter, more powerful-looking, with a commanding presence you felt instantly any time she entered a room. Chevelle was skinny, tall, pale, intense in her own way, but without nearly the force of the Lestra's personality. All the novices were afraid of Chevelle, of course, because she could be sharp-tongued and unforgiving, but what they felt for the Lestra was awe, bordering on terror. They respected her, of course, but from a distance. They were all afraid she would look at them, speak to them, call them up for some momentous and valiant task. Eleanor herself had never had a conversation with the Lestra, and frankly hoped she never did. "Mother, we praise you," Chevelle was intoning, and all the novices murmured after her again. "Mother, we bend before you. Mother, we draw from you all grace and offer to you all our own strength. Grow full with the riches of our bodies." Around her, Eleanor heard the voices of the other novices rising and falling with the same melodic cadences of Chevelle's. Beside her, Eleanor's cousin, Rosary, had her eyes closed, her hands clenched. Her whole body appeared tense with rapture. Rosary had embraced the pale mother with all her heart, flung at the Silver Lady's feet all her considerable ability to love. Eleanor marveled at the transformation sometimes, for Rosary had always been the most passionate and willful of girls, the one most likely to inspire the anger of her father or the sorrow of her mother, the one all the kinfolk had shaken their heads over. "She'll be one who comes to ruin," the uncles and brothers had predicted. "She's the one who'll bring disgrace to the family." And she had, or almost. Falling in love where it was most disastrous, causing great consternation and negotiation among the clans, the Sabbata, almost causing a clan war to hear Eleanor's father talk about it. And yet here she was, at Luminan Convent, speaking the pale mother's name with the sort of reverence she had once reserved for her wholly unsuitable lover. The truth was, Rosary had inexhaustible passion. If her father or her brothers had been able to convince her to marry within the clan network, the Sabbata Rhys, she would have been the most devoted wife imaginable. She would have borne many children and loved them all so deeply their hearts would never have been lost or cold. She could have been an icon among the Sabbata, a beacon, a lesson held up to all the young girls. "See, this is how a Lyran woman lives. Make her actions your ideal." Chevelle lifted both arms above her head, the elbows pointed out, the fingertips just touching, the complete circle, the full moon. The novices giggled and twittered as they made their matching pattern on the ground, grouping themselves into one large round shape made up of many girls in white robes. From the sky, Eleanor supposed, they did resemble a full moon, albeit one made up of restless, moving components that could not stand entirely still no matter how much they were admonished. Chevelle led the singing, and they all raised their voices in the sweet ritual of the evening song. There was always some jostling for position, some girls preferring the outer edges of the circle, some the core, all of them trying to guess where Chevelle would make her first divisions. Some wanting to stay, some tired and wanting to go. Chevelle, still singing, walked the perimeter once, then began tapping on the arms of the novices bunched on the east side of the circle. Slowly, gradually, they drifted away, still singing, their voices growing fainter. Slowly, it was as if the moon shape on the ground went through its phases, full, almost full, gibbous, half, till finally what was left in the courtyard was a quarter moon that mimicked the waning crescent that would rise later tonight. The novices who had been dismissed entered the convent and disappeared. Those who had been chosen remained outside to sing until midnight. Eleanor was content to be one of those left behind. Chevelle was uncannily good at making sure no one sang too many late-night rituals in a row, though, of course, during the earliest phases of the full moon they were all out almost every night, reflecting back a whole, round shape to the brilliant Silver Lady. Late in the month, though, fewer and fewer voices were needed, until on the evening of the new moon, no one stayed and no one sang. The next night, Chevelle would single out 15 or 20 novices to create a bare sliver of a curve. The next night, a larger group would stay. And so it went, every night after that, until the moon was full again, and all 500 and some novices stood beneath the pale mother, reciting her praises and her glories. Eleanor did not mind the grand choruses, the full-throated choir of 500 offering exaltation to the goddess, but she preferred the smaller groups, the quieter ensembles, the rituals under a night sky that held almost no moon at all. She always tried to be on the proper side of the circle the night before the new moon, so that she would be among the women Chevelle selected to sing. On those nights, it was as if the moon had disappeared completely, and only the stars looked down, cold, still, crystalline. It was only on nights like those that she did not miss the Lyrans. They had not asked her to accompany Rosary to Luminan Convent, her father and her uncles. They had not discussed with her whether or not she wanted to go. They had merely told Eleanor to pack her clothes. She would be leaving with her cousin in the morning. She would be off to take vows at Luminan Convent, where she would live with the daughters of the Pale Mother and dedicate her life to the Moon Goddess.
"It is just temporary," her mother had whispered to her as she helped Eleanor pack. Her mother was weeping, holding up first one simple dress, then another, and burying her face in the familiar folds. "This exile is temporary, only until the men decide what's to be done with Rosary. 1 year, perhaps, 2 at most. You will be back among us soon."
But now, 1 year into her life at the convent, Eleanor knew 2 things that her mother did not. Novices rarely left Luminan. So far, in fact, Eleanor had not seen one of them go. And Rosary had developed a fanatic's blissful attachment to the Moon Goddess. She would not want to leave. Indeed, she would throw all her considerable force of will into a show of intractability if they tried to take her. And if the formidable Lestra decided she wanted Rosary to stay at the convent, Eleanor thought it very likely Rosary would never leave. The men of their family might finally have met their match. It was something that gave Eleanor an intense satisfaction. Chevelle moved among them, poking and prodding to make sure they all kept in their proper scythe formation, tilting her head to listen critically to their singing. Eleanor required no realigning. Her feet had barely moved. She was not a restless girl who could not stand quietly for a paltry hour or two. Eleanor had as much will and resolve as her cousin Rosary, but she exercised them in a much different fashion. She could focus. She could narrow down. Chevelle nodded in approval and continued her way around the outer curve of their pattern. Eleanor had been glad to learn she was leaving with Rosary, glad of a chance to get free of her father's constant attention, her brother's imperious, impatient criticism. She loved them, but great mother, she could not breathe when they were around. That was her life. That was the life of every Lyran girl, to be guarded and guided by the fierce men of the Sabbata, and a girl never rebelled against them and won. Since she had been a child, Eleanor had dreamed of slipping away in stealth, of climbing out her window some starless night and running from her father's house. She had studied maps in secret, tracing her best route, noting which roads ran too closely to other clan holds and must be avoided. She had listened to tales of the country over the Lyrith Mountains, trying to divine what life was like for women who lived in Gilengaria, and wondering if she would find it any more to her taste. She even listened to stories brought back from the true adventurers, the ones who had sailed to foreign lands with names like Arborharst and Sovenfeld. What kind of life did women lead in those places? Could Eleanor travel so far and be happy? Was there a way to escape? She never ran, never packed her bundles and tried. In truth, Eleanor was afraid she would miss them all too desperately to enjoy her freedom, if she was able to attain it. What she wanted, she realized, was to live among the Sabbata, close to the many that she loved, but free of their incessant surveillance and interference. To quit the influence of her father and brothers and uncles and male cousins, she would have to marry. And then she would be subject to her husband's dictates and answerable to his relatives, who would feel perfectly free to scold and correct her. To be free of them all, she would have to leave. So she had been thrilled at the prospect of crossing the mountains into Gilengaria and going to live at this convent she knew nothing about. To serve a goddess she had never heard of, in order to provide company for a cousin she had never been particularly close to. She had quickly learned that, in its own way, life at the Luminant Convent was just as restrictive as life in a Lyran household. Every novice had a rotating set of household duties, cooking, cleaning, working in the laundry room, chopping wood, gardening. And every novice was expected to participate in at least two of the six devotional rituals held every day. Decorum was strictly enforced, and except for singing, raised voices were not allowed. There was no running, no dancing, and very little laughing, though novices were encouraged to keep pleasant smiles upon their faces. It almost went without saying that absolute chastity was required, even though several hundred soldiers lived inside the Luminant compound, many of them young and handsome enough to stir any girl's heart. No, the convent was not the right place for Eleanor either. But she was not unhappy here. The quiet, contemplative life suited her, and she enjoyed the quick friendships she had formed with the other girls. She found it easy to avoid Chevelle's ire because she was not high-spirited and dramatic, and she rather liked doing her part of the domestic chores every day. Now and then she rather wistfully watched the soldiers stride from their barracks through the courtyard and out the great gate. What would it be like to get to know one or two of them, form a friendship with a man who had not been approved by her father? But more trouble lay down that road than she was willing to risk, so she would watch them a moment or two and then look away. She found herself fascinated by the religious ceremonies, by all the rituals designed to honor the Pale Mother. She loved the circles the novices formed every night, the slowly slimming and burgeoning shapes designed to reflect the changing phases of the moon. She loved her moonstone bracelet, glittering with a private fire that she could always feel as a definite heat against her wrist. She was curious about this goddess who seemed so powerful, so pervasive, and yet so elusive, shyly hiding her face one week, brazenly staring down from the heavens the next, capricious and beautiful. Like Rosary, she thought wryly, the Pale Mother was a bewitching mistress who held everyone at the convent in thrall. Eleanor herself loved a different goddess, but they were sisters. Surely they did not mind sharing worshippers. In the Lyrans, there was only one deity, the Black Mother, the Dark Watcher, the great goddess of the night, whose attention was just as close and protective as that of anyone in the Sabbata. It was said she knew the name of every child, every crone, in every clan, and spent each night counting them over again before she fled the oncoming day. Concerned that something might have happened to her people during the hours she was gone, as soon as the sun went down, the Black Mother hurriedly spread her shadow back over the Lirin lands and began her counting all over again. To help her in her task, the Lirin folk often turned to face the eastern horizon right at sunset and softly offered up their names. Eleanor, Rosary, Winlow and Torin, I am here where you left me last night. Eleanor had worried just a little that the Black Mother might not be able to follow her over the Lirith Mountains, that when she left her family, her Sabata, and her country behind, she might leave her goddess as well. But the Dark Watcher was here in Gilengaria, as she was in the Lirans, comforting and omniscient, wearing, as always, her scattered jewels of starlight. Whenever Eleanor looked up to sing her praises to the Silver Lady, the Black Mother was always there as well. In fact, most of Eleanor's hymns and obeisances were offered up to the Dark Watcher, not the Pale Mother, but no one had to know that but Eleanor herself. At midnight, the quarter moon dissolved, at least the one on the ground, shaped by novices, and the girls moved slowly through the courtyard, up the stone steps and into the convent. The massive doors opened onto a huge hall, echoing and not particularly welcoming. The high ceiling, ribbed with supporting stone arches, was lit by wheeled chandeliers. The stone floor was cold underfoot, even in the middle of summer. Eleanor always moved as quickly as she could through this space and into one of the labyrinthine corridors that honeycombed the five-story building. For the first 2 weeks she had lived here, she had been lost every day. Now she took the twists and turns without thinking. Rosary was in the room they shared, but not asleep. There was a single candle burning in the window, similar to candles set in every window of the convent, and faithfully lit as soon as the sun went down. In addition, the room was illuminated by a branch of candles pulled over by Rosary's narrow bed. Rosary was braiding her long chestnut hair for the night.
"Chevelle will be furious if she sees you burning candles this late,"
Eleanor commented as she stepped inside. Rosary shrugged and blew them out. The room instantly filled with shadows, only the flame in the window giving any light to see by. Eleanor waited by the door until her eyes adjusted, then carefully crossed the room to her own bed. Rosary said,
"I just wanted to wait up for you, and it's so gloomy sitting in the dark."
Eleanor rather liked the dark. More than once, back at home, she had stayed up all night, just to watch the changing constellations across the night's obsidian face. Of course, back home, she'd been able to sleep the next day through, which wasn't an option at the convent. Here, everyone was up and working shortly after dawn.
"Did you get a letter from home?"
she asked, because she'd seen the unfolded sheets spread out on Rosary's bed.
"Yes," the other girl said happily, and instantly launched into a recitation of who had gone courting, who had been sick and recovered, who had argued with his father but quickly come to his senses.
Eleanor listened while she cleaned her face and put on her night clothes. There were blood ties between their families, so they were related to many of the same people, but they would have called each other cousin in any case. Eleanor's Alloa family and Rosary's Plessa family were both part of the Doman Sabata, and everyone in the Sabata considered everyone else kin. More tenuous were the relations between clans within the Sabata Rhys. Those alliances were based on friendship and necessity as opposed to blood, though a man might call another man cousin just because they both belong to one of those nine great networks of interconnected families. Those of the Doman Sabata belonged to the Laja Sabata Rhys.
Any man of the Laja Alliance might call on any other to defend him if he fell afoul of an enemy. These days there was much less clan warfare than there had been in the past, of course, but there was still great hostility between some Sabata, some alliances that would never be made. Rosary, for instance, had fallen in love with a boy from the Bramlis Sabata, bitter enemies to the Doman. It was for this transgression that she had been exiled to the Luminan Convent. She had announced her intention of running off with him, crossing the Lyrith Mountains and disappearing somewhere in Gilengaria, where they would live as husband and wife, with no fathers or brothers to interfere. Eleanor had actually rather been hoping Rosary made the escape, just to see if it was possible. But, of course, Rosary had not been successful in her bid for freedom. The Bramlis boy's father had been just as eager as Rosary's to make sure the match did not occur. Only the Great Mother knew how his family had dealt with him. Rosary had been shipped off to the Lestra.
"Oh, and our uncles are back in Coravan,"
Rosary was continuing with her recitation.
"My mother thought they might come by to see us here, but I don't think that would be allowed, do you?"
"I'm certain it wouldn't be," Eleanor said with a laugh. "Do you want to ask Chevelle for permission, or no? Would you like to go straight to the Lestra?" Rosary giggled.
"That's what I told her last time she asked, but she doesn't seem to understand that Sabata means nothing in the convent. I don't know how to explain it to her."
"No, for anyone raised in the Lirans would have a hard time comprehending that the Lestra, a woman, could be absolute law within her own defined circle." Eleanor and Rosary, used to submitting to authority, had recognized it immediately in the persons of the Lestra and her dedicants. But the men of their families would never find it so easy. Eleanor lay back on the narrow mattress and half-listened to Rosary's continuing story. Strange as it still seemed to her, Eleanor had kin in Gilengaria. So did Rosary. One of the Laja women had eloped more than 30 years ago with a man named Heffel Coravan, Marlord of one of the 12 houses. Naturally, the men of her family went after him, for that was the Liran way. If an outsider tried to ravish or romance a Liran woman, one of the men of her family would face that outsider in a duel to the death. Usually, the Sabata men won, or more often the threat itself was enough to keep Liran women safe from the attention of interlopers. Not this time. Heffel Coravan had killed his bride's father and carried the woman off to his estates at Coravan Keep. Normally, that would be the end of it. The woman would have been lost forever to the Sabata Rhys. But somehow, Heffel had managed to earn the respect of his wife's relatives and had forged a durable relationship with them. There was visiting and some commerce between them across the Lyrith Mountains. Eleanor was not sure exactly how it had all unfolded, but she knew that Heffel was the one who had suggested the Luminan Convent as a place to send the wayward Rosary. He was a devout man, a follower of the Moon Goddess, and he had described the convent as both safe and holy. And so here they were.
"I would like to go to Coravan someday," Eleanor murmured as Rosary's voice drifted to a stop. "Wouldn't you?"
"No? Why?"
her cousin demanded. "To meet the man who stole a Liran woman from the clans?"
Rosary sniffed.
"He did not steal her. They let him take her." "He killed her father,"
Eleanor reflected a moment.
"Although her father wasn't very well liked, and maybe wasn't such a loss."
"That's what I mean. The Sabata allowed it."
"I'd still like to meet him. I'd like to meet his daughter. You realize we have a cousin who is only half Liran?"
"Two," Rosary corrected. "She's got a brother."
Eleanor nodded in the dark.
"So I'd like to meet him, too. And I'd like to see Coravan. Oh, I'd like to see any part of Gilengaria. Gosen Hall or one of the 12 houses. I'd like to be free to roam anywhere I wanted to. Wouldn't you?"
"No," said Rosary, turning over on her bed and twitching her blankets up to her chin. I'm happy where I am, except I miss the Lirans. I miss the Sabata. If I could, I would spend half my life on this side of the Lirith Mountains and half on the other side. Eleanor sighed.
I miss the Sabata, too, she said. If we were home right now, we'd be planning the baking for the high harvest.
Rosary chimed right in, describing the recipes they would be selecting, the spices they would be mixing into the pies and soups. It was a game they played often, if we were home right now. Eleanor could not decide if the exercise made her more homesick or less, but she did know that she could remember every detail, every scent, every color, every name. She did not think she would ever forget any of them, if she lived at the convent until she was 100. Her whole life, she had wanted to run away from the clans, but she had always wanted to be able to go back home. Once she left the convent, she would be able to return to the Lirans. But if she left on her own? Slipped away in the night or chose a rash lover and eloped? She would never be able to return. She would forfeit the Lirans forever. In the morning, after they had attended the first set of devotions, Rosary asked Eleanor to dye her hair.
I'm baking today, Eleanor said. I'll be free in the afternoon, and I can do it then, and you can do mine.
So, shortly after lunch, they returned to their room and set about the time-consuming but pleasurable task of marking their hair with Sabata patterns. A few of the other girls who lived on their floor had always been fascinated by this particular ritual, so Rosary had invited them in to watch. When Eleanor arrived in the room, buckets of water in hand, she found Rosary sitting on a stool in the middle of the room, hair unbound and touching the floor. Five other novices had crammed onto the two beds and were giggling and gossiping. They were all boy-crazy, always discussing the charms and characteristics of the young men in the Lestra's guard, never mind that they were forbidden to speak to the soldiers or interact with them in any way. Talk about the soldiers formed their primary topic of conversation.
Did you see him? I think he's from Tilt. So handsome. I never saw eyes so blue. Chavelle will murder you if she thinks you're flirting with one of the new guards. I wasn't flirting. Well, I would have, but he wouldn't flirt back. I think he's shy. I like that other boy, the one with the fair hair and the scar in his left cheek. He has the sweetest smile.
Eleanor pulled up a second stool right behind Rosary's and ran her palm down the thick, straight hair. It was a reddish chestnut, many shades lighter than Eleanor's own night-black hair. It was marked all down the back with the sickle, rose, and star design of the Plessa family, done in a blonde dye. Every few weeks, as new hair grew in, Eleanor added another row to the pattern near the top of Rosary's head. Every few months, she trimmed off the ragged ends at the bottom and some of the old designs with them. Every Lirin woman wore her hair this way, long and marked with her family heraldry. Of course, in most situations, certainly in public, a Lirin woman kept her hair rolled up in some manner on her head, in braids or in a knot, so the patterns were not visible, but everyone knew they were there.
I talked to Dakin the other day, one of the other girls said in a dreamy voice.
You didn't, and Chevelle didn't see you?
Just a few words. He was so serious.
Rosary sat very still, while Eleanor dampened her hair with a sponge, then separated the thick locks into five sections. She opened the small container of dry dye and rubbed the top with a damp sponge, then transferred the color in deliberate strokes to Rosary's hair. The sickle was easy, the star a little more complicated, the rose the hardest symbol of all to translate. Eleanor worked carefully, with the skill of much practice, knowing how important it was that the final result be perfect.
If anyone were to come across Rosary, lost or ill or dead, unable to speak, he could unpin her hair and know exactly to which family she belonged, even if she was found by one of the warring Sabata, one who hated the Plessa family. She would be returned to them, safe from further harm. If a Lyran girl were ever to chop off all her hair, she would be lost forever. No one would recognize her. No one would know how to send her home.
"You know who I haven't seen for a few days?" said one of the novices. "That young man from Fortinald, Kelty. I liked him."
There was a gasp, and then an ominous silence that lasted long enough to make Eleanor look away from her task. Even Rosary turned her head, carefully, to keep the dye from running.
"You haven't heard?"
That was Astira speaking. The tall blonde from Marinstow was the one Eleanor liked best of all the novices. At 22, Astira was Eleanor's own age, and both of them were older than most of the other girls.
"Kelty's disappeared. They found Rostiff and three others, but Kelty just vanished."
"Found them? What does that mean?"
Eleanor demanded. Astira gave her a wide-eyed look. She had patrician features and a well-bred air, and Eleanor had always assumed she was part of the Gilengaria nobility.
"Found them dead," Astira said solemnly. "Murdered."
All the girls were exclaiming now with dismay and fascination. Their words tumbled over each other. "Murdered? How? Who killed them? And why?"
"What happened?"
Eleanor asked. Astira shook her head.
"I don't know all the details," she said,
which meant that she only had this much information because she'd been eavesdropping on conversations she was not meant to hear.
"They were about a day's ride away from here, maybe two. Someone said they were looking for mystics. Someone else said no, they were merely carrying messages for the Lestra. At any rate, their bodies were found outside some little hut miles off the main road, buried in a common grave, blood all over the floor inside the house. No one else around. None of the people who lived anywhere nearby knew what had happened to the soldiers or the woman who used to live there."
The novices all listened, rapt with horror. Eleanor and Rosary, who had grown up with violent men and knew a bit more about combat than the rest of the girls, were even more shocked and impressed than the others. They knew what kind of skill and manpower it took to overcome five soldiers fighting for their lives.
"But then, what happened to Kelty?" one of the girls asked. "If his body wasn't found..."
"Maybe he was abducted," another novice replied. "Whoever killed the others took him, to torture him, to make him tell them things."
The first girl, the one who was sweet on Kelty, started crying.
"They took him," she said with a sob. "They took him, and they'll hurt him, and they'll kill him after all."
She didn't specify who she meant by they, but all of them knew. Everyone else in the room was nodding.
"May the Pale Mother strike them all down," Astira said. "Mystics."
"Are they really so terrible?"
one of the younger girls asked. She hadn't been at the convent very long, so she could get away with asking the question that Eleanor knew better than to raise, though she had wondered it silently many times.
"Yes,"
Astira replied with emphasis, while Eleanor returned her attention to Rosary's hair.
"They're evil. They contravene the laws of nature and the laws of the goddess. They... well, here's a story I just heard. There's an island off of Danilustris on the western coast. That's where they send people who are dying with a fever that has no cure. But now mystics who have the power to change themselves and other people into animal shapes, these mystics are going to the island and turning sick people into dogs and horses and who knows what, changing them from humans into beasts."
"Why?"
breathed the youngest novice.
"I heard about that,"
Rosierie said. Animals get that same fever, don't they? Except there's a cure for it in dogs and horses. Isn't that right?
Eleanor looked up from the pattern forming between her fingers.
You mean mystics change people into animals so they can be cured? Do they change the animals back into humans when the fever's gone?
I don't know, but it's still an abomination, Astira exclaimed. The goddess made each of us into the shape she most desired. We can't just decide to be something else, something she did not sanctify. You should have heard the Lestra when somebody brought her this news. I'm surprised the whole convent didn't come tumbling down. She was so angry.
Eleanor concentrated on her task again, holding the dye-soaked sponge to Rosary's hair. But she was thinking about this extreme form of healing. Eleanor herself was very good in a sick room. Only a few times in her life had she encountered a fever that she could not defeat. She rather liked the inventiveness that had caused a mystic to take such drastic action, simply to save a few lives. She knew better than to say so, of course. Here in Luminan Convent, no one would ever defend a mystic. Word of the soldiers' deaths had spread through the whole convent by dinner time, but there was never any official announcement about the incident. The girls sat in their usual orderly fashion at the long tables in the dining hall, completing the meal in three shifts as they rotated through the stages of cooking, eating, and cleaning. Chevelle passed among the tables for all three dining shifts, more tense and critical than ever, so no one wanted to speak too much or ask for additional helpings. Eleanor and Astira were among the final group of diners, trying to eat as quickly as they could so they could leave the oppressive atmosphere, when there was a stir and a murmur from the girls closest to the door. Soon, in one graceful ripple, the whole crowd had come to its feet, and the Lestra walked down the aisle between the two center tables. As always, Eleanor found herself both hoping she didn't draw the Lestra's attention and incapable of looking away. There was such a heavy, insistent glamour to the woman. Her very body seemed to absorb whatever light was available, whatever air was in the room. While she was nearby, it was impossible to look anywhere else or think about anything except pleasing her. The Lestra paced slowly between the tables, nodding coolly as each novice dipped her head in a submissive bow. She wore her usual black robes, heavily embroidered in silver. Her hair, long as a Lyran girl's, fell in a loose braid of gray and black all the way to her knees. Her face was set, her dark eyes unreadable. She stopped right in front of Astira and stared for a moment at the tall, blonde girl. Astira had lowered her head and did not look up as the Lestra studied her. Astira was a good 5 inches taller than the older woman, but she did not seem to have the advantage. There was something about the Lestra that was magnificent despite her short stature.
You shall come with me tomorrow, the Lestra said. We shall leave at noon.
Yes, my lady, as it pleases the goddess.
Pick someone else to come with us as well. We shall be gone 2 days, possibly three. You ride a horse, don't you?
Yes, my lady.
Make sure your friend does also.
That was it. The Lestra abruptly turned and retraced her steps, leaving as swiftly and deliberately as she had entered. Not until the door had closed behind her and there was no chance she was still near enough to hear did the room erupt into an excited chattering of awe and speculation. The Lestra had moved among them, spoken to one of the novices.
"Where will you be going? What does she need you for?" Rosary demanded.
Astira shook her head.
"I don't know. Not just to offer benedictions to travelers, because she would send us out with Chevelle or one of the other dedicants. A 2 or 3 day trip. Surely we will be going to Neft, at least. I have not been outside of the convent for 2 months.
Neither have I, several girls replied in wistful voices.
The Lestra had said Astira should pick one of her friends to go on this journey with them, and it was clear everyone at the table was hoping she'd be the one Astira favored. But the Marinstow girl was already smiling at Eleanor.
You'll come, won't you? I know you can ride.
Eleanor actually shivered with excitement, to be out of the convent for 2 days at least. Whether they went to Neft or merely camped out on the side of the road, the prospect of a change of scenery was giddily alluring.
I will. I do. Let's go back right now. I can't wait till morning.
Chapter 4 They set out the next day, shortly after noon, a cavalcade of 8. In addition to the Lestra, the novices, and 4 guards, their group included Daris, another one of the dedicants. Despite the violet robes, she was nothing like Chevelle, being plump and short, and altogether more kind. She was also one of the oldest daughters at the convent, for she had to be more than 60, Eleanor thought. She was the one all the novices turned to if they had a problem, and if they could find her. She was most often closeted with the Lestra, or working in the infirmary, or bustling about on convent business and hard to track down. Chevelle, on the other hand, was always available, especially when you least wanted her. They traveled in near silence, except for the noise the horses made. Astira and Eleanor, of course, were too overwhelmed to speak, though they exchanged wide-eyed glances now and then. 2 guards rode before the women, 2 behind, and made no conversation that Eleanor could overhear. Now and then, Daris and the Lestra murmured together, but never for long. Eleanor imagined that, in years of living at the convent together, the 2 women had already discussed every topic that might come up. At first, they traveled through woodland, for the convent was located deep in the forest, but gradually they won their way to a main road, cutting through more open terrain. The day was warm and a little humid, so Eleanor was a little sorry to leave the shade of the trees, but at least now she could gauge the position of the sun and guess their direction. She nearly clapped her hands together as she realized they were heading northwest. Neft, she mouthed to Astira, who smiled in delight. Sure enough, by the time the sun began to set, they were pulling up on the outskirts of the city. Eleanor felt her head practically swivel on her neck as she tried to take in all the sights at once. There was no such thing as a city in the Lirans, just the occasional clusters of Sabata families living in a more tight-knit community than others. Astira had said Neft was small by the standards of Gosenhall, but Eleanor found it hard to imagine anything more grand than this place, with its crisscross of streets, its clutter of buildings, its press of people, its sounds, its smell, its energy. The guards did not pause as they crossed into the city proper, though they had to make their way more slowly through the crowded streets. Even Eleanor could tell that some parts of town were more respectable than others, for they moved past buildings that had a slovenly look, dirty and ill-kept, and into districts where the storefronts were neat, the window boxes weeded, the doors covered in fresh paint. Eventually, they climbed a rather steep hill and came to a halt. They were outside an elegant 3-story building located on about an acre of land enclosed by a wrought iron fence. One of the guards helped the Lestra from the saddle. The other women dismounted without assistance. Then the guards gathered up the horses.
Come for us tomorrow around noon, the Lestra directed. We will know then if we want to leave or stay another day.
Yes, my lady.
Daris pulled back the iron gate and the Lestra strode in, the others trailing behind her. The wide front door had already been opened, and servants were bowing low, some of them touching their fists to their right shoulders. The Lestra swept by them as if they were invisible. Feeling just as invisible themselves, Astira and Eleanor followed Darris inside, then craned their necks to take in the opulence of the furnishings. Lush carpets, gold statuettes, high ceilings, stained glass. Certainly richer than Eleanor was used to, either at the convent or back home. They were quickly ushered into a large parlor that was littered with chairs and sofas and small tables. An elegant, middle-aged, dark-haired woman rose to meet them, holding her hands out to take the Lestras in a warm clasp.
"Coralinda, so good of you to come. You're looking well."
"Thank you, Janetta. The goddess watches over me. Are you tired? Are you hungry? Would you like to eat or rest a while?"
"We can do that later. Take me to your mother first, since her situation is so grave."
The woman swept a doubtful look over the rest of the entourage.
"All of you?"
"Yes. We shall take the night watch in shifts, so they should all meet her now.
Follow me."
Another parade through the lovely house, this time up a curving staircase, whose walls were hung with formal portraits of rather grim men and women. Down a hall, past a few closed doors, and then into a chamber that was obviously a sick room. There was the odor, for one thing, of bitter herbs and fevered flesh. There was the low light. There was the stick-like woman on the wide bed, a smothering of covers concealing everything except her head. Her nose was prominent and sharp, her hair loose and gray. Everything else about her was vague and indeterminate. Her eyes were closed, and her breathing was so shallow it did not disturb the blankets over her chest.
"We shall pray for her," the Lestra announced, "and then we shall stay with her, one of us, from now until she dies."
Their hostess flinched at the uncompromising word.
"The doctor said it could be as early as tonight, but he did not think it would be more than another 3 days."
The Lestra nodded.
"We shall stay that long, if that is the case."
She made a motion with her hand, and the daughters arranged themselves around the bed. Darris and the Lestra stood on either side of the woman near her head, the novices at her feet. Together, they chanted the prayers that asked the Pale Mother's mercy upon this woman, that begged the Silver Lady to gather this soul into her own bright radiance and add its light to hers. "Take her gently. Turn her sacrifice to glory. May her face shine beside yours from the wide circle of the moon." Eleanor itched to come close enough to lay her fingers on the old woman's forehead, to stroke her hands, now buried under the covers. Back in the Lyrens, everyone wanted Eleanor nearby if there was illness in the house. But she had to be able to touch her patients to gauge what was wrong and if she could help them. This old woman was so frail and so ancient that it might be merely age that was shutting her body down, in which case there was nothing Eleanor would be able to do. But if there was a disease, a fever, a rebellion in the blood, well, it was possible Eleanor would be able to make her well, or at least ease her transition from this life to the next. But there was no chance to touch the old woman, even to lean forward and lay a hand across the covered feet. The Lestra concluded the prayers and turned to look at her hostess.
"Very well," she said. "Darris will stay with your mother for a few hours, then I will, and then my novices will take the night hours at her side. Feed us. Let us get some rest, and we will do what we can."
Within half an hour, Astira and Eleanor were curled up in a small bedroom on the third story, having eaten a quick meal in the dining room. They were supposed to be sleeping, of course, but they were both too excited by the strangeness of their circumstances to be able to settle down. First, they discussed the journey itself, then the sights that had caught their eyes as they moved through Neft, before turning their attention to their current situation.
"So, why are we here?" Eleanor wanted to know.
I didn't think the Lestra went to private houses to perform sacred rituals, or sent her novices in to watch over the dying.
Astira was sitting up in the bed they shared, her arms locked around her updrawn knees. The room was dark, except for the light of a single candle set in the window.
Usually not, she agreed. But Janetta Giseltes is a cousin of the Lestra, and she married into money. She is constantly donating funds to the convent, so there is every reason for the Lestra to show her special attention.
She looks noble.
Janetta? Yes, but only 13th house, like me.
I don't understand what that means,
Eleanor said.
There are 12 great houses in Gilengaria, Astira said patiently. She had explained this more than once before. The owners, the Marlords, possess most of the property that's worth having, and when they die, they pass it on to their sons and daughters, the Saramar and the Saramara. But they own so much land that they can't really control or cultivate at all, so they each have vassals. High-born lords and ladies who hold properties in trust for the Marlords. Many of them are second cousins of the Marlords, or seventh sons of sixth sons. Nobles, with noble blood, just not the highest connections. They're referred to as the 13th house, no matter which of the 12 houses they hold allegiance to. It doesn't tell you where they're from, it just tells you their status. She shrugged. They're good, but not good enough. Or I guess I should say we're not good enough.
And Giseltes? That's the name of one of these 12 houses?
Astira giggled.
Yes, silly. One of the most powerful.
And the Lestra, she's from Giseltes?
Yes. If she was not the Lestra, you would properly call her Sarah Coralinda. Her brother is Marlord Helcon.
Astira gave an exaggerated shiver.
Have you ever met him? He's a little frightening. Very intense. The way the Lestra is, only with him, you think it could turn to violence. I don't like him much. Fortunately, he doesn't come to the convent often.
It's all very confusing. We don't have titles and nobles among the Lyrans.
No, you just have these complex arrangements of kin. No one could keep track of such things.
Eleanor was surprised.
It's very easy. There are individual families, and they band together to make up a sabbata, or a clan, and a number of clans make up the sabbata res.
Astira flung up a hand.
No, please, I won't be able to keep it straight. Everyone was so astonished when you and Rosary came to live at the convent. I don't believe any of us had ever met a Lyran girl before.
I never thought to travel across the Lyrith Mountains, Eleanor said.
Astira unwound her hands and stretched out on the bed, yawning a little.
And why did you? Because Rosary fell in love with some boy? Is that it?
Eleanor laughed and lay down beside her, though she wasn't at all sleepy.
A boy from the Bramlis Sabbata, yes.
Is it true that Rosary's father would have killed him if he'd caught them together?
No, but it might have started a clan war.
What's that?
It was difficult to explain.
It's when all the families of the Sabbata Res declare hostility on the families of another Sabbata Res, and if members of one family see members of another somewhere, they'll start fighting. Brutal fights, bloody. A lot of people die. You never want to be the clan that's overmatched, so if anyone in your family needs to travel, he takes 5 or 10 brothers or cousins with him to defend him on the road. It's stupid and it's pointless. And it can go on for years, Eleanor added bitterly. All the young men dying, all their friends swearing revenge. Rosary's father wanted to do anything to prevent another clan war. That's why he agreed to send her away.
Astira had lifted her head and was now supporting it with her hand, clearly fascinated.
But that's so, so exotic, she exclaimed. People taking up arms against each other and what, dueling in the streets if they happen to encounter each other in the town square? There are no town squares. There are no towns. But there is a great deal of travel on a few essential roads, and the battles are most likely to occur on one of these journeys. Eleanor stretched her arms over her head. Oh, you're right, it is complicated. There are some Sabbata that almost always stay neutral, and they try to mediate disputes. There are some families that live close to the roads, and they want to avoid having their own young men